Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Christina Rodriguez, professor of law at New York University Law School, discusses how political, legal, and cultural burdens should be distributed and shared to help countries manage the change produced by immigration. Professor Rodriguez's lecture was the 2007-2008 James A. Thomas Lecture at Yale Law School.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you first to Jim and Debbie Thomas, and also to Harold. It's an incredible honor to be able to address this gathering. And I'll say that the last time I was actually standing at this end of room 127, I was actually a college student, and I was in a debate about California's Proposition 187, which was a referendum that would have denied benefits to undocumented immigrants. And I didn't really think at the time that 14 years later I would still be talking about immigration, but here it goes. So an estimated 200 million people are on the move around the globe today. Though it's important not to overstate the novelty of today's global migration, it is the case that during the period of time bookended by the Cold War and the first decade of the 21st century, migration has achieved what one demographer calls unprecedented velocity, mass, spatial extension, and complexity. In 1965, international estimates put the number of total migrants at 75 million. In 1990, it was 120 million. And in 2000, it was at 175 million. The number of migrants grew more in the last decade of the 20th century than in the previous 25 years. And today, the estimates are at least 200 million people around the world. The United States is in the midst of its own demographic reordering, brought on by levels of immigration unprecedented in American history. Between 1971 and 2000, nearly 20 million immigrants came to the United States through formal legal channels, almost 2 million more people than entered between 1891 and 1920, the last major period of migration-fueled transformation in the United States. Between 2000 and 2005, approximately 7.9 million immigrants arrived in the United States, the largest number in any single five-year period in U.S. history. As a percentage of total population, of course, immigrants today represent a smaller cohort than at the turn of the 20th century, but not by very much. Compare today's approximately 12% of the population to yesterday's 15% of the population. But it is the case that if current trends continue, as the Pew Hispanic Center has estimated, that by 2050, nearly one in five Americans will be an immigrant. And by 2025, the immigrant or foreign-born share of the population will surpass the peak during the last great wave of immigration a century ago. The Latino population, if these numbers continue on their current trajectory, will triple in size, accounting for almost 30% of the population of the United States in 2050, as compared to 14% in 2005. But yet, as a percentage of global total population, 200 million people is actually quite a small number of people. And so the movement that's occurring around the world is relatively minor. What's more, in the United States, even though we by far and away receive the most immigrants of any country in the world, we place far down on the list of rank order countries in terms of number of migrants as a percentage of total population. Immigrants represent a small number in the United States, as I said, 12% of our population, as compared to 25% in Australia, 23% in New Zealand, and 19% in Canada. And we actually do have some evidence that in the United States, immigration rates have stopped accelerating and are leveling off, and that immigration is approaching a kind of steady state, or perhaps even a decline. Border apprehensions are down, remittances are down to Mexico, and some social scientists emphasize that the demographic factors that are pushing immigrants to the United States from Mexico, namely the size of the young population in Mexico, are likely to shift in the next decade or two. So then, what then is the reason for all of this immigration-related Sturm und Drang on the national airwaves, in the national political debate, and perhaps most vividly, as Harold mentioned, in the state houses and city councils across the country where people are clamoring for a solution to the immigration crisis? Indeed, there's something manufactured about the immigration crisis here at home, and I wouldn't even call it that necessarily. And it's a sense of crisis that's characterized by a simultaneous concern for the health and welfare implications of illegal immigration and the failure of immigrants from Latin America in particular to assimilate into American society. Now, on the subject of illegal immigration, which dominates the public and political discourse, the most that can be said about its consequences is that it's having distributional effects in depressing the wages of Americans at the bottom rung of the socioeconomic ladder. Though the actual effects on wages are indirect and difficult to measure, and they're likely to be relatively small. These impacts are not insignificant, but they're also not the stuff of major social upheaval, and I don't think it's what's behind a lot of the opposition that's articulated. Indeed, high rates of growth in the foreign-born are not necessarily associated with worse employment outcomes for the native-born. On the subject of assimilation, the best available evidence demonstrates that immigrants today are learning English at the same pace, if not even more quickly, than in previous generations. The second generation is clearly English dominant, and even among immigrants themselves, 33% of those who've been in the United States for 10 years or fewer are proficient in English, a number that rises to over 70% once immigrants have been in the United States for 30 years or more. Similar statistics can be marshaled for other indicia of assimilation, and the demand for naturalization, which is the ultimate form of incorporation, has grown dramatically in recent years. For example, in fiscal year 2007, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service received over 1.3 million applications for naturalizations. That's more than twice as many as it received in 2006 and 2005. In other words, not only do immigrants recognize that English language ability provides the framework for ultimate upward mobility, they're more importantly responding to naturalization drives and other incentives to make permanent commitments to the United States and on America's cultural terms. But I think it's this clamoring for citizenship that actually helps explain the consternation that characterizes the debate over immigration today. Even if we reach the peak of the historic wave of immigration around 2000, we're still at the leading edge of a process that takes time, a process of absorption and integration, a process of discerning the medium and long-term impacts of historic immigration on American society, something we're unlikely to know within our own lifetimes. So our existing institutional capacities to manage this process are exceeded by demand. The head of the USCIS, for example, says it doesn't have the capacity to process this number of applications. And a recent study by the Migration Policy Institute concludes that the need for language and literacy instruction dwarfs the scale and abilities of the current system to manage the process of integration. What's more, the dispersion of immigrants from the traditional destinations like my home state of Texas and California and my adopted state of New York are making these challenges particularly acute as immigrants head to places that heretofore have not seen many immigrants, namely the Southwest. It's the newness of these encounters between immigrants and Americans, as well as of the immigrant populations themselves, that compounds the perception that immigration is a process out of control. So the fundamental source of this anxiety, I think, is suggested by scholars of language conflict, like Mark Schell from Harvard, who observes that the typical human response to the babble of languages is to carve out a space in which only our language is spoken. The impulse towards homogeneity generally reflects the natural human desire to want our environment to be completely scrutable. To experience it otherwise is to experience a loss of control or a loss of mastery, an experience that's brought home daily when we're asked, and this causes a surprising amount of anxiety in people, to press one for English, or when Spanish language signage becomes a disorienting feature of what Canadians call the visage linguistique. Immigration, the point is, like the larger phenomenon of global integration of which it's a component part, changes the terms of the social bargain, creating new winners and new losers, and heightening the member-stranger dynamic that has always shaped our political relations, whether we think of them from the micro perspective of the family or the macro perspective of the nation state and its sovereignty. Indeed, it's this perception of an assault on sovereignty that's brought home by the size and scope of the illegal population in particular, estimated to be about 12 million strong, that makes large-scale immigration a source of concern. Whatever demographic transformation is occurring appears to be occurring without our consent. And thus, the understanding of sovereignty that's most often invoked when discussing immigration today is what I call the sovereignty of the fence, of the absolute right of the nation state and its citizens to exclude. It admits to no power-sharing limitations, whether between the United States and the world or between the federal government and sub-federal entities. The power of this framing comes from its basic and easily apprehended premise. How can a nation be sovereign if it can't control its borders? Now, in what follows, I will challenge the viability of the sovereignty of the fence as a way of conceptualizing the problem of immigration that we face, and call for an alternative conception of sovereignty to frame our immigration debate that draws from principles of reciprocity, comity, and burden sharing. A conception I believe is politically achievable despite the impulse toward homogeneity and exclusion, which is difficult to counter. As a matter of our own constitutional law, the sovereignty of the fence has its origins in the 19th century conceptions of the law of nations. In 1889, in Che Chenping versus United States, otherwise known as the Chinese exclusion case, the court traces Congress's power to exclude Chinese laborers from the United States, not to the Constitution, but to the sovereignty that precedes the Constitution. The court conceptualizes sovereignty as embodied in the idea that jurisdiction over its own territory is a proposition which we do not think open to controversy, because it's an independent right of every nation. If a sovereign cannot exclude aliens, the court warns, it would be, to that extent, subject to the control of another power. In Ecu versus United States in 1892, another exclusion case, the court appeals similarly to international law and the maxim that every sovereign has the power, as inherent in sovereignty and essential to self-preservation, to forbid the entrance of foreigners within its dominions, or to admit them only in such cases and upon such conditions as it may see itself fit to prescribe. And this is the key, the conditions that it sees itself fit to prescribe. And in Fang Yue Ting versus United States, when the court extends this conception of sovereignty from the exclusion context to the power to summarily deport those who have in fact already been admitted, it cites Vattel's Law of Nations for the proposition that the nation's right to remove foreigners summarily stems from what it owes to itself, the care of its safety. Now, though our immigration policy today is actually quite open, and as Peter Schuck has emphasized, tends towards the expansionist despite consistent public preferences for more limited immigration, the sovereignty of the fence still looms large. It is reflected in the view that a government unable to control its borders is not a competent or trustworthy government, or one that's doing its most basic job. All other dealings with outsiders, all other immigration policy, must flow from a controlled border. The architectural metaphor of the fence is a way of reinforcing rhetorically that we have control or can achieve it with the right technology, with an actual fence, or the right commitment from Congress. Perhaps more importantly, at least in the context of political theory, this conception of sovereignty is also reflected in the framing of immigration as a domestic political issue and in the widespread presumption in the law, in political theory, and in public discourse that whom we admit for membership is a function of our domestic needs, our own design, our own grace, as opposed to a function of the relationships and obligations we have in the world. But what we actually need is a theory of control or migration management with more possibility than this one. In strong form, this theory would recognize that the sovereignty of the fence is futile because migration cannot be stopped despite our preferences. In weaker form, it would regard the sovereignty of the fence as incomplete or inattentive to today's realities, given the strong logic of migration, as well as our labor and demographic needs for a population replenished through immigration. What we need is a framework for understanding and channeling the new forms of association to which migration is giving rise that reduces the sense that immigration is a phenomenon out of control and approaches it instead as a phenomenon that can be managed to productive effect through the sharing of burdens or through an ethic of reciprocity. This form of sovereignty would recognize that immigration is something that does not happen to us, but rather is a process in whose unfolding we are active participants, participants who simultaneously have rights and responsibilities. To formulate how we should go about managing large-scale immigration, we should invoke conceptions of sovereignty that revolve around ideas of reciprocity or comity. It would recognize that our sovereignty is limited both externally by events in the world as well as internally by liberal democratic commitments that shape how we manage the effects of events in the world. This realization would lead us to an ethic of burden sharing, a concept often employed in the context of refugee allocation and resettlement, but that should also have purchase in the context of migration generally. Now, in the immigration context, reciprocity would not be symmetrical or equal. The nations and people who are dealing with one another are not similarly situated, nor do they have equivalent interests. The ethic would involve a consideration of interests, not to balance them, but to promote mutual concessions over time. So a conception of control based on comity and reciprocity, I believe, is ultimately more stable, more usable, and more defensible from a democratic perspective than the sovereignty of the fence. To say this is emphatically not to say that sovereignty does not include the power to control borders, but rather that the ways in which power is both conceived and exercised should take account of the United States as part of a community of states with mutual obligations and interests that would be served through cooperation. In making the claim that limits on our sovereignty should be reflected in our immigration policy, I also by no means intend to suggest that these limits are judicially enforceable. In fact, in its modern incarnation, the plenary immigration power articulated in the Chinese exclusion cases is nothing more than a doctrine of judicial review, arguably. But its existence does not exclude the possibility that Congress, in its formulation of immigration policy, does not have unrestrained power. Now, I want to develop this concept of burden sharing in three stages. First, I'll bring into view why we need a theory of control or management in the first place. Second, I'll explain why the sovereignty of the fence is neither tenable nor justified and should instead be replaced by conceptions of burden sharing and reciprocity. And third, I will identify some examples of burden sharing, both with respect to first-generation immigration policy and second- and third-generation integration concerns that are subjects of debate today. So it should not come as a surprise that the last major wave of immigration from 1891 to 1920 was accompanied by heated debate over controlling borders, a debate that culminated in an aggressive Americanization program sponsored by the government and advanced by Theodore Roosevelt, and a paradigmatic shift in immigration policy from largely behavioral restrictions on immigration, the exclusion of prostitutes, people with loathsome diseases, people likely to become public charges, to the National Origins Act of 1924. A quota system designed to prevent the American population from changing in its ethnic composition. As Aristide Zolberg has observed in his sweeping study of the history of American immigration policy, A Nation by Design, the imposition of limits on immigration was well nigh inevitable because a concatenation of changes associated with the globalization of capitalism and the demographic revolution in the final decades of the 19th century induced a sudden and worldwide escalation in the number of people on the move internationally and the distances they covered. Sounds familiar? So the question at that time, of course, was what form the restriction that was inevitable was going to take. There was nothing determined or necessary on that score, and over a 30-year period, various interests, many of which have analogs today, weighed in on the question. Warning bells were sounded by public officials and in the popular press about criminal Italian Catholics, venal Eastern European Jews. In the 1890s, The Nation recommended that only English-speaking immigrants be admitted, and the nearly three-decade battle over whether to adopt a literacy test as a screening mechanism for new immigrants took off. Though neutral on its face, the literacy test was understood to be a mechanism of excluding Southern and Eastern European immigrants, and it became a cause célèbre among progressive reformers, as well as the likes of Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, whose strong conceptions of sovereignty and Anglo-Saxon supremacy made him a League of Nations opponent and an immigration restrictionist. Now, incidentally, the form the literacy test took was to require immigrants to read the U.S. Constitution in not English, but in their native language. And the debate that actually took place was which languages were sufficient to administer the literacy test, and particularly whether Hebrew and Yiddish would be acceptable languages in which people could take the literacy test. No understanding of the Constitution was required, just the capacity to read it. Now, support for the literacy test ebbed in response to foreign policy distractions like the Spanish-American War, entreaties by the business community, and pressure by northern politicians who were after the immigrant vote. It rose in relation to the ambivalence of labor unions, populist sentiment that was fed by interventions by social scientists who inflated statistics indicating that half of the white population in 1880 was foreign-born, as opposed to the reality of one-third of the population. And then ultimately by the national security crisis of World War I. Indeed, the arrival of new ethnic groups was linked to the war, precipitating the disappearance of formerly robust German language schools, newspapers, and the deportation of many Eastern European radicals back to Russia during the same period. Now, the resonance of this history today is perhaps best encapsulated by a statement published in The New Republic in 1916. The editors were opposed to the literacy test, but on the grounds that it would not be a particularly effective mechanism of selecting the right sort of immigrant. They wrote that free migration was one of the elements of 19th century liberalism that was fated to disappear, in part because it was a danger to an industrial democracy with an incipient welfare state. In other words, the rise of the democratic welfare state would make it difficult to sustain strong public support for immigration, making the turn towards exclusion necessary. Now, that immigration puts pressure on the welfare state and challenges the cohesiveness of liberal democracy in today's world is apparent in various ways. In Europe, for example, the maintenance of a robust welfare state arguably depends on a kind of thick social contract, a commitment to a national community that's forged by a sense of belonging to one and the same people. A commitment to a common project of social support depends on participants sharing strong affinities, which are largely absent in the relationship between an entrenched society and newcomers. As Robert Putnam has explained in his research on the impacts of ethnic diversity, those societies in the long run develop mechanisms for creating new forms of social solidarity to dampen the negative effects of diversity and create new and more encompassing identities over the long haul. The social solidarity on which the welfare state policies depend is clearly challenged by the arrival of new ethnically diverse immigrants in the short term, which creates a sense of distrust within the community. As Michael Walzer explains it, a democratic society cannot justify treating immigrants differently from citizens. Members must be prepared to accept, as their own equals in a world of shared obligations, the men and women they admit. As a result, a society has to be very careful about whom it admits. And the demand that immigrants be treated as citizens justifies keeping the border closed and tightly controlled. Under this formulation, the sovereignty of the fence is actually required to secure democratic cooperation on the inside. But that cooperation extends to the foreigner, whose interests are protected from arbitrary government enforcement. Now, even in the late 19th century, in the jurisprudence of Chinese exclusion, limitations on the sovereign's power to act summarily against the foreigner were perceived. Whether these limitations were understood as modifying the sovereignty of the fence or as articulating a parallel domestic conception of sovereignty is less important than the recognition that the logic of exclusion did have limits. In Chen Qianping, for example, Justice Field, writing for the majority, acknowledges that there are exceptions to the full and complete power of the nation within its own territories, but they must be traced to the consent of the nation itself. In dissent, in Fang Yue-Ting, he takes us a step further, rejecting the majority's conclusion that the power to deport flowed seamlessly from the power to exclude, on the grounds that aliens admitted with the consent of the government could not be deported without constitutional restraint. Arbitrary and despotic power, he wrote, can no more be exercised over them without reference to their persons or property than over the persons and property of native-born citizens. He invokes the language of common humanity and finds that they're protected by all the guarantees of the Constitution. In Ye Guo, where the court applies the Equal Protection Clause to the case of Chinese immigrants who had been systematically denied permits to operate laundries that had been systematically granted to non-Chinese, the court observes around the same time, sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to law. But in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people, by whom and for whom all government exists. From there, the court underscores the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are secured by constitutional principles that are themselves the monuments to the progress of the race in securing to men the blessings or civilizations under the reign of just and equal law. And that the very idea that one person may be compelled to hold his life or the means of his life at the mere will of another is intolerable in any country where freedom prevails. Now, today, these views have matured into constitutionally grounded protections for the rights of non-citizens, primarily through application of the Due Process Clause. The question for us, though, is whether these limitations on the sovereign power of the state, vis-a-vis immigrants already admitted, necessarily depend on maintaining the sovereignty of the fence, or whether these are cracks in its armor, proof of its limitations. Now, I don't think there's any doubt, following Walzer, that we face an admissions status trade-off of a kind when formulating our immigration and integration policies. More immigration translates into less support for immigrants' rights, and more robust immigrants' rights translate into less support for immigrant admissions. But despite the admonition of certain liberal theorists, the United States has fairly consistently made the admission status trade-off in favor of more admissions and less status. The admission status dynamic was, for example, apparent during the 1996 immigration reforms, which excluded lawful immigrants from many public benefits programs, but did not restrict immigrant admissions. The reforms also made it easier to remove non-citizens by expanding the definition of aggravated felony to include quite minor offenses, suggesting a heightened desire to expand control over the immigrant population in exchange for permitting immigration levels to remain at already high levels. During the immigration debates of 2006 and 2007, guest worker programs came back into vogue. The grand bargain that emerged from the Senate in 2007 would have adopted a temporary worker program without a path to citizenship to fill the needs of our labor market. In other words, the compromise would have accepted the presence of high numbers of immigrants needed to fill our labor market needs, but it would have done so without a generous extension of the indicia of belonging, including the presumptive right to remain in the United States. Perhaps most telling of the way that we've made this trade-off is the brute fact of unauthorized immigration. The 12 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States today demonstrate that we do not have an appetite for treating the immigrants on whom we clearly depend as potential citizens, preferring them instead to do their work without any real security. Now, a variety of explanations, I think, can be ventured for this dynamic, including the proposition that it's legitimate and understandable to favor members of one's family over strangers, particularly when resources seem tight. It's a defensible proposition that we owe a duty first and foremost to our compatriots, and treating immigrants presumptively as citizens, particularly during a time of large-scale migration, can be seen as compromising redistributive objectives or commitments we've already entered into. But these very choices that we've made in the admission status trade-off underscore, I think, why the sovereignty of the fence does not advance the cause of managing migration today or thinking about these relationships, because it's actually inconsistent with our behavior. As I've said, our need for an alternative conception of sovereignty can be described in strong or weak terms. The strong argument acknowledges that migration is inevitable, or that globalization and its economic effects make it almost impossible for the nation-state to control its borders completely. Whether we like it or not, there are external constraints on sovereignty. Saskia Sassen has identified two of them as economic globalization and the rise of an international human rights law regime, concluding that these two forces reduce the autonomy of the state in immigration policymaking, contrary to the longstanding assumption that the autonomy here, it wasn't even a question of autonomy, it was a question of absolute power, despite the state's desire to nationalize immigration policy in response to populist pressure. Immigration under this formulation is not a matter of altruism, but rather arises from our labor market needs, as well as through the network effects of our political, military, and foreign aid policies. As Alejandro Portes and Ruben Rumbaut have demonstrated, our economic and foreign policy choices result in the creation of social networks that facilitate migration, even once economic incentives have disappeared or diminished. They emphasize that Mexican migration to the United States in particular is the result not of individual calculations of gain, but of forces that are buried deep inside the history of the relationship between the two countries. Forces that include NAFTA, to be sure, but that are also the result of a history of contact and colonization between the two societies. In addition, the wage differential between the United States and Mexico, the explosion of the young working age cohort there, and the powerful economic logic of immigration are all invoked by social scientists and commentators to support this inevitability claim. Like the sovereignty of the fence, this point of view is premised on the belief that immigration cannot be controlled, but instead, believing that it can be stopped, this view accepts the futility of trying, opting instead for a strategy of management. Now, a weaker version of this claim emphasizes that the limitations on our sovereignty that unauthorized immigration suggests are self-imposed, but for good reason, that we are not about to abandon. The costs of realizing the sovereignty of the fence are simply too high. The money thrown at border enforcement is not justified in terms of the gains and exclusion achieved. Liberal democratic states are particularly bad at preventing unauthorized immigration because of our aversion to state coercion and fear of unleashing discriminatory state behavior, products of liberal commitments we're not about to revisit. And it should not be surprising, and I don't think it's a coincidence, that the states that have the highest percentage of immigrants to their total population and also the least of a problem with illegal immigration are states like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Singapore. So no matter how you characterize the economic interdependence that produces immigration as either an insatiable desire for inexpensive labor or a function of a native population that is simply better educated and largely liberated from performing menial jobs and therefore in need of supplementing through immigration, it's a benefit that we are loath to give up, on top of our inability to use the state coercion that would be necessary to actually make the sovereignty of the fence work. As demographer Dowell Myers forcefully argues, as a population, we're on our own demographic precipice, with the baby boomers set to retire, triggering a desperate need for rejuvenation of our population through immigration. A claim that my parents, who were born in the first 2 years of the baby boom, find a little bit unsettling, but it's a need that's nonetheless acute in the United States, and particularly acute in European societies, making immigration the sociopolitical issue of the day. Now, none of these characterizations is compatible with the sovereignty of the defense, of the fence. Modern-day policy is expansionist because it has to be. The turn to the exclusion of the 1920s is not a viable option today. And even then, as Atlantic migration was significantly curtailed by the United States turned to Mexico for supply of immigrant labor that it needed. So even then, the logic was not fully operational. Indeed, the exclusionist rationale imagines the United States as capable of acting to keep the world out or to let it in on terms it has determined unilaterally, when in reality, our immigration policy is like a puzzle piece that fits into a set of broader patterns. To figure out how to shape it, its edges, we have to consider the shape of the other pieces in the pile, which themselves must be shaped with reference to one another. It does not make sense in isolation, but only when fit together with other complementary pieces. Now, I think the question is whether we can do better than the admission status trade-offs that we've been making, particularly on the subject of illegal immigration. Whether we regard cross-border traffic as inevitable or too costly to stop, can we develop a conception of sovereignty that acknowledges the impact of development, trade, and hemispheric integration while remaining true to our democratic values and diffusing public concern over demographic transformation? I think a better framework that might achieve this possibility for addressing the challenges posed by migration would treat the sovereignty of the fence as an unrecognizable construct and would instead frame immigration and its management as a function of our place in an interdependent world. Reciprocity is demanded by interdependence, and we must constantly be considering what each participant in the process, sending societies, receiving societies, immigrants, and resident members must give up. And in exchange for what? I think this necessarily requires internationalizing our perspective on migration in order to understand where the benefits and the burdens lie. But as I will explain, it does not mean giving up on territorially grounded conceptions of citizenship or embracing a post-national ethos, and it revolves around an emphasis on mutual obligation and cooperation to promote interests. Of course, burden sharing is an abstract concept and does not in and of itself actually tell us who should be carrying what weight. It doesn't tell us how specific we need to be in identifying what burdens should be borne and how they should be shared. And I doubt that we could quantify complicity or participation in the factors that generate migration. And as social science develops on the question of why migration occurs, as well as how migration affects economic development in sending societies and social cohesion, growth, and budgets in receiving societies, the distribution of burdens and benefits will have to differ. The framework also ultimately will not keep us from having to make important value judgments either about equally legitimate and important interests. As I ultimately will explain, development goals in sending societies and democratic imperatives in receiving societies may not actually be fully reconcilable. But as I understand it, reciprocity or burden sharing would not be about assigning proportional culpability or symmetric burdens, but would rather acknowledge interdependence more generally, thus suggesting the range of interests that should be taken into account when formulating our immigration policy. To break it down further, we should understand it as having two components. We should think about external reciprocity, or how burdens should be shared among nation states, and internal reciprocity. When the world crosses our borders, for reasons in which we participate, how are we supposed to act, and how should we expect immigrants to act? I conclude now by offering some examples of how I would apply this concept of burden sharing to some issues of contemporary concern, recognizing, again, that the weight assigned to the interests I have outlined may depend on how facts on the ground develop. Along the external dimension of reciprocity, the debate over high-skilled immigration and economic competitiveness stands out as a debate whose terms might change under a burden-sharing framework. During the immigration reform debates of 2007, Bill Gates famously testified before Congress that if we didn't expand the number of opportunities for software engineers to enter the United States, Vancouver stood to gain a new office park, that he would move his operations north. We have a clear need in certain high-end segments of the labor market for workers. Indeed, immigrants are actually the most highly and least educated members of our society. And our educational system and its flaws are related to shortages in certain high-tech sectors and scientific sectors. Now, the focus of this debate has been on shoring up American competitiveness. But in a speech in New York City in 2006, Mary Robinson offered a different perspective on this issue, emphasizing a human rights-based version of the brain drain critique. She foregrounded the example of the Philippines, whose healthcare sector has been seriously diminished by our steady recruitment of Filipino doctors and nurses to compensate for our own nursing shortages. Now, if we took the idea of reciprocity seriously, we would consider whether in our zeal to maintain our economic status and to solve our problems, we weren't also being rapacious. Knowing how to weight these interests, of course, requires knowing whether the draining of human capital is compensated for by remittances, the feedback effects on host societies of migrants who are educated or gain professional training abroad, and the long-term investments in infrastructure that many high-skilled migrants make in their countries of origin, a source of debate in the literature. Whether we can be this high-minded and think in these terms, we might also at the same time factor in the impact of our use of long-term high-skilled migrants on long-term development prospects in countries that are producing immigration flows and consider the consequences of the feedback loop. Now, if we took the idea of reciprocity seriously, we would also realize that Congress cannot address the problem of unauthorized immigration unilaterally. Instead, we would hammer out a labor migration agreement with Mexico, one in which the United States agrees to work toward regularizing Mexican migration by liberalizing its own system, at the same time that Mexico agrees to adhere to certain benchmarks and investing in economic reforms that will alleviate pressure on the border, and to shoulder some of the responsibility for taking care of its citizens abroad, at least in the short term. Steps Mexico already is taking through its vast network of consulates, its engagement of state and local governments, and pilot projects such as the investment in Southern California of resources into the creation of a healthcare facility for Mexican nationals. This sort of an approach that emphasizes the Mexican government's cooperation and obligations could contribute mightily to securing public confidence in the United States, because it would make clear the two-sided interest in managing migration across the U.S.-Mexico border, diffusing the perception that immigration is something inflicted on us without our consent, in favor of a picture of immigration as a phenomenon being managed by the various parties involved in its unfolding. This is something along the lines of what President Bush had in mind way back in 2001, but we had not seen it come to fruition. Of course, when it comes to the question of low-skilled or unskilled immigration in particular, any claim that we should engage the primary sending societies through a labor migration agreement is likely to be met with the question of why this burden can't be borne through foreign aid or fair trade policies or through a massive infusion of development assistance into Mexico on the model that the European Union followed in its investments into Southern Europe as part of its effort to prevent an imbalance in labor migration when the common market became a reality. I would not rule out any of these possibilities for fairer distribution of global resources or as long-term solutions for demographic stability if those were our goals. My point here is that reciprocity must be reflected in our own immigration policy for the simple reason that our interdependence with Latin America does not produce certain conditions abroad alone, but rather has given rise to and will continue to give rise to populations of actual people within our border. Development, the saying goes, produces migration as people move to the cities and then across borders. In other words, the consequences of our interdependence are intimate and immediate and result in person-to-person relationships that are not simply abstract but physical and real, and migration management must take this into account. Now, as I've emphasized, it's these person-to-person contacts that can be destabilizing, particularly when they take the form of unauthorized immigration, especially of low-skilled, uneducated migration. In thinking about how to manage this particular aspect of today's migration, I take as my starting premise the assumption that unauthorized migration should in fact be reduced because of how susceptible it makes immigrants and their communities to state coercion, and because it undermines confidence in government and political support for immigration reform. Though at the same time, I do acknowledge that there are some, chiefly economists, who emphasize that illegal immigration is actually the most efficient sort of immigration because such immigrants are highly responsive to shifts in the labor market, but yet are entitled to almost nothing in return from the state. Whatever we decide to do about the 12 million unauthorized immigrants who are in the United States today, there is consensus across the board that the possibility of a future migrant flow must also be addressed. By now, I hope I've made the case that the fence, both literal and metaphorical, or outright exclusion, and the conception of sovereignty that embodies is neither wholly viable nor appropriate. I want to address now how my burden-shifting framework should lead us to think about the leading reform proposal for managing this future flow, the guest worker program. Now, on the one hand, a guest worker program would seem to be an embodiment of ideas of reciprocity. The receiving society, the United States, has engineered for itself a bargain. The sending society and the guest worker also win in the bargain. A temporary worker program suits the labor market needs of the United States. It satisfies domestic employers and consumers. It also suits the development needs of Mexico, which relies heavily on remittances from abroad, but would also like its citizens to return. Though the United States arguably loses something in the form of these remittances and under some versions of the program has to spend to provide for housing and healthcare, what this cost is actually probably lower than the investments that the United States would have to make were the migrants to come in as future citizens. What's more, a regularized flow of migration promises to protect immigrants from exploitation by smugglers and employers, as well as from the general anxiety that's typical of life as an unauthorized migrant. These programs appeal to current and future migrants by providing them with the legal means to support their families at home or start home construction projects or business ventures at home. Indeed, as research by Douglas Massey and the Princeton Migration Project has shown, the Princeton Mexican Migration Project has shown, were it not for the gradual but serious tightening of border controls begun by the Clinton administration and enforced by the Bush administration, much of what has occurred as permanent resettlement of illegal migrants would actually have been cyclical migration. Border enforcement makes it more difficult to cross and therefore more costly to return. But Mexican migration left to its own devices would be cyclical, and a well-designed guest worker program would facilitate that circular movement in the interest of the United States and Mexico. But yet the success of this bargain is highly contingent, and there is no such symmetry in the relationship between the immigrant and American society. The overwhelming weight of historical evidence and comparative evidence suggests that migrants' intents change in ways they may not foresee when they sign onto guest worker contracts. And guest worker programs that are truly temporary, a program the likes of which no Western liberal democracy has ever seen been able to administer, ultimately force migrants into an untenable choice, either to become unauthorized when a visa expires, or to compromise the economic, social, and family ties they've built as during their time as guest workers. Indeed, it's not possible to open up these kinds of networks without expecting some kind of permanent resettlement. But perhaps more importantly, the initial bargain that's struck imposes externalities on the United States in two ways. Particularly to the extent that guest worker programs actively facilitate circular migration, they permit immigrants to treat the United States as a way station to greater economic and social mobility at home. There are civil society implications to permitting such transitory migration. Immigrants become disconnected social actors with no reason to act in ways to better their communities in the long term. This is a form of behavior that's likely to exacerbate the distrust that Robert Putnam's research has shown arises in ethnically diverse settings. This lack of social connectedness is likely to have an impact not only on the public's willingness to tolerate the guest workers' presence or take account of their interests, but also on the public perception of the Latino population in general, fueling the treatment of Latino characteristics as ones that are truly foreign rather than ones to which we must adapt. Precisely what happened during the Bracero era of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when Mexican Americans, legal immigrants, and Bracero workers were thought to be all part of one society. By creating a temporary laboring class without full participation rights, or even the prospect of full participation rights, guest worker programs introduce opportunities for exploitation into social, political, and economic relations. But as Michael Walzer frames it appropriately, I think, guest workers perform socially necessary work and are immersed in and subject to our legal system. Given this, the we-they lines that we draw with our immigration policies should be based on the assumption that many of them will eventually become us, if not in the immigrant generation, then certainly in the second generation by virtue of our birthright citizenship rule. Instead, the power of the state, exercised primarily through the employer, looms tyrannically over guest workers in the form of the constant threat of deportation. So how do we balance the autonomy interests of immigrant individuals, a principle that's embodied in the claim that we should devise immigration strategies that take account of changed intent, with the interests of the United States and Mexico? The debate over guest workers, I think, actually highlights the limits of the reciprocity framework. The external and internal imperatives may conflict. The immigration solutions targeted at one level might compromise dynamics or burden sharing at the other level. And I think this is the most difficult of questions. If a guest worker program is best for Mexico, but we conclude that it's anathema to us, what do we do? In the end, I think our democratic commitments must shape the ultimate solution. Exclusionists would say the same, but I would expand the sphere of commitments that we take into account, making exclusion untenable. And so I would suggest two related forms of burden sharing. On the one hand, no temporary worker program should be adopted without providing immigrants with a presumptive right to become permanent residents and therefore citizens, provided they adhere to the terms that are consistent with human rights norms. At the same time, we could recognize the significance of cyclical migration and make such a transition an option rather than a requirement, but nonetheless require workers after some limited period of time to make an election to either return to Mexico permanently or make a long-term commitment to the United States with the obligations of assimilation that that entails. To make this arrangement feasible, we must extend our openness to dual citizenship to our own naturalization process. Mexico has already performed its end of the bargain by changing its laws to permit its citizens to retain their status if they naturalize abroad. And countries such as France, Canada, Russia, and the UK have taken similar steps in permitting naturalized citizens to maintain their citizenship of origin. Now, the last point I'd like to make is that this idea of burden sharing doesn't just apply when we're talking about the first generation question of how to formulate our immigration policy. It also applies when we deal with the follow-on consequences of immigration, when we deal with more direct integration concerns, so I don't think it's possible to separate those two completely. Instead of a strong conception of cultural hegemony, the cultural equivalent of the fence, where we're resistant to the idea that immigrants might maintain some of their original cultural characteristics, or that society might change, and that the rules of assimilation are determined by our own grace as opposed to the preferences of the people involved, we might adopt a conception of reciprocity and burden sharing to inform how we conceive of the process of immigrant assimilation, or the multi-generational process of absorbing newcomers. Now, it goes without saying that the long-term challenge presented by large-scale migration requires that immigrants have mobility, mobility that's secured through the learning of the English language and the transition out of ethnic communities, and that this is required to achieve the integrationist objective. And it's quite right to expect immigrants to make these efforts. But incorporation also depends on extant members of the receiving society displaying a reciprocal willingness to assist and adapt to immigrants. In this instance, the dominant culture is understood not as a hegemon, but as a sovereign limited by its obligations of reciprocity. The willingness to assist might take the form of a commitment to providing translation and interpretation services in order to make institutional bureaucracies navigable, to devote actual resources to adult language education, as opposed to lip service to the idea that English is our common language through English-only grandstanding. And the willingness to adapt requires openness to change. This is an admittedly more elusive concept, yet no less important a concept that could include the adoption of certain immigrant customs and tolerance of linguistic pluralism, both forms of adaptation that have existed or occurred throughout American history. Now, my own favorite example of the struggle over these consequences is represented by the rise of the English-only workplace rule, a new favorite target of the EEOC and an increasingly common basis for complaint since the mid-1990s. These rules, which employers adopt either at the behest of customers or employers who resent or feel alienated by the speaking of languages other than English in the workplace, generally arise not in settings where a large number of non-English speaking recent immigrants work, but rather in those settings where the non-English is spoken by bilingual workers, albeit workers with varying proficiencies in English. And so in some ways, this is actually a third generation consequence of the migration that's fueling the transformation today. And as with the first generation immigration policy questions and the second generation integration concerns, I believe that in thinking through whether these rules are legitimate expressions of the assimilation imperative or misuse of the cultural majority's power, the burden sharing framework is again useful. I begin from the premise that we must associate in the public sphere with those who are there in a way that takes them as they are. The very basic obligations of citizenship include acknowledging and dealing on respectful terms with those we encounter in the public sphere. To expect that one can enter the public sphere without having to deal with people different with different cultural attributes is unreasonable and impractical. I understand and embrace the fact that a certain amount of friction will result, particularly when it comes to language differences, which create zones of almost complete inscrutability. But the inevitability of friction does not absolve participants in the public sphere of the obligation to help diminish the friction. Speakers of non-English have an obligation to communicate with their English-speaking colleagues and customers in a mutually intelligible manner, even when that communication might prove difficult. But the reciprocal obligation requires English speakers to tolerate the speaking of non-English in their presence. The burden sharing I advocate in this context would introduce what linguists call the communicative burden, which captures the fact that all people, including speakers of the majority language, bear a responsibility for helping to facilitate mutual understanding in situations where different accents or the speaking of different languages introduces friction. The English-only rule places the communicative burden almost entirely on one party. Naturally, the non-English speaker should attempt to learn English, and bilinguals should refrain from using their ability to speak a non-English language to separate themselves from their coworkers. But in a multilingual society, and this is the important point, which a society profoundly shaped by recent immigration will be, the concept of the communicative burden must include acceptance of the fact that one may not always understand what is happening in one's environment. Everyone, including the bilingual, will find him or herself in this position at some point because of the multilingual character of our immigration. And there is no principled reason, only a hegemonic one, that plays on the same ideas as the sovereignty of the fence for monolingual English speakers to never have the sense of being in the linguistic minority. To be sure, bilingual individuals are best positioned to engage in self-help. They're uniquely positioned to reduce friction by speaking the dominant language. A burden-shifting framework could take this into account and might even require that when engaging in common tasks or in common settings, only English be spoken. But people eventually are likely to assimilate these costs into their aesthetic sense of what life on the job includes. Permitting cracks in the social dominance of English to be heard may well have learning effects, transforming linguistic cacophony from an anxiety-producing phenomenon into the familiar. The bottom line is that, particularly in an age of migration, when the temptation will be significant, it is important to avoid overinvestment in the cultural or demographic status quo, or in insulating ourselves from the change that integration inevitably brings. Cultural evolution of the assimilating immigrant, as well as of the receiving society, is not only unavoidable, but also to the good. I'm largely agnostic with respect to what American society should ultimately look like as an aesthetic or cultural matter. On the one hand, the most recent sociology of language acquisition makes me confident in assuming that immigrant languages stand only a very small chance of surviving across the generations. Though I should add the caveat that lost opportunities for widespread bilingualism are losses, not gains. But at the same time, the history of the disappearance of other immigrant languages, German in particular, is marked by sufficient coercion to convince me that it is crucial that we pay attention to how the assimilation process unfolds across the generations. But the most important point worth absorbing is that we should not resist the reciprocal imperatives of integration in an effort to stop the change that immigration and incorporation produces, in part because that change produces value. As Anthony Appiah explains, cultural purity is an oxymoron. Though homogeneity provides comfort, as Appiah notes, we do not need, have never needed, settled community, a homogeneous system of values in order to have a home. But what we do need are anchors for belonging, even for transient populations. Social scientists have produced a fascinating literature on the transnational lives of migrants that are no longer organized around the nation state. But transnational forms of belonging represent a limited aspect of citizenship practices, even today. Even transnational identities must be grounded in networks of people and institutions, which will have presence in some territory, hence the conflicts I've been discussing all along. Indeed, as I emphasized at the outset, the perception of disruption to these institutions that immigration creates through the introduction of new members is precisely what makes immigration a hot-button issue in most democratic societies. And it is this perception of disruption that moves people along all points of the political spectrum to invoke the sovereignty of the fence, of exclusion, of the status quo, or better yet, of a mythical nation that has never actually existed when thinking through immigration and integration policy alike. So the question that remains is whether the political will exists to move beyond the conception of sovereignty that does not describe how we behave as a nation state. The answer may very well lie in the very fact that when it comes to matters of immigration, our sovereignty is not impenetrable or indivisible. In this lecture, I have noted how factors beyond the direct control of Congress, namely social realities in the United States and Mexico, are creating new members of American society in the form of unauthorized immigrants without legal status. Managing migration has proven to be less a function of hermetically sealed decision-making by nation states, translating into clear allocation of responsibility of each nation to its own citizens, than a venture that requires an acceptance of limitations on the nation's power to exclude. I thus have sought to make the case that the terms of immigration policy have changed in a way that requires self-conscious power sharing by receiving societies such as the United States. But another direction in which we might pursue this concept of power sharing is to focus on the crucial role that states and localities play in spreading and sorting the burden of migration management, of providing diverse outlets for consideration of how best to manage processes that a fence cannot contain. We could productively spend another hour discussing the various ways in which subfederal entities are contributing to this process and how a more and better use of the mechanisms of decentralization to perform the sorting function can help give Americans the sense of control that the sovereignty of the fence promises but cannot deliver. The point simply to be made here is that we would be better off abandoning the idea that when it comes to immigration, we speak with one centralized voice unilaterally and without reference to the rest of the world, and acknowledging that adapting to immigration-related change requires exchanging outmoded conceptions of sovereignty, like the sovereignty of the fence, for a conception that ultimately expects less of our government, but more of ourselves, so that everyone in the end can do better. Thank you.